Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Good evening, and welcome to the Green Egg Radio Hour. I'm Ariel Monserrat.
And I'm Sylvie Salou.
Our special guest tonight is Tom Donahue. And Tom is a retired teacher from Lowell High School in San Francisco, where for 20 years he was best known as Mr. Donahue. In the years prior to that, he was a public health microbiologist, first in bacteriology, then in virology. And he taught biology and physics in high school. He's also been a researcher on telomerase at the Blackburn Lab, UCSF, where he worked with Nobel Prize-winning geneticist Elizabeth Blackburn. He was voted Best High School Biology Teacher of the Year in California, and he's been listed in the Teachers Who's Who at least 7 times. He's been a member of Church of All Worlds for over 20 years, but considers himself pagan since the age of 7. He also has an identical twin brother who is pagan. Tom was born and raised in Pennsylvania, where he lived until the age of 30, when he went west to California and settled in Berkeley, California. In 2004, he and his wife, that would be me, Ariel, were hand-fasted and have been together ever since. The following year, Tom and I moved to a very small town in a farming community in the Appalachians in Tennessee. And I'm going to turn it over to Sylvie tonight because we've only got one phone in our home, and Tom's the one being interviewed. So take it away, Sylvie.
All right.
Hello?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Oh, how are you doing, Sylvie? I'm doing fine tonight, actually. Well, except for the weather annoying the heck out of me. These chemtrails
I hear you. It's annoying down here, too. Or over here, I should say. So we're going to talk about aquatic ape theory tonight. And I think I'm going to start this off by asking, what is aquatic ape theory and who came up with that?
Well, actually, the very first person to come up with it as a theory turns out to be a man named Alastair Hardy. And he was a professor at Cambridge, but he didn't produce it. He didn't present it as a formal paper. It was just something he had come up with from his own observations. Certainly the most popular person who has ever written about it would be Elaine Morgan, who actually at this point has 5 books to her credit, all of which are about the aquatic theory. But from my own point of view, I actually came up with it independently. Now, this was only a matter of hours before learning about Elaine Morgan, and I might tell that story later on. It's a theory that proposes that we humans had a significant period in our evolution that we spent in water. Now, whether we were fully aquatic or just partially aquatic, it's really difficult to say, but it certainly shaped who we are. We have so many differences from all of the other primates, and the only explanation that covers all of these differences is the aquatic theory.
Well, do we, just a question right off the top of my head, do we have any commonalities with ocean animals?
Yes.
Or?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, that's very important to everybody who talks about the theory. We, as humans, have extremely large brains for our body size. We are almost completely hairless, except on our heads and chins for males. And yet we have a layer of subcutaneous fat, just like whales and dolphins and manatees, and like that. Humans are the only primates that have enlarged fat-filled breasts, but many aquatic animals do, most notably the sirenians, the dugongs and manatees, which were originally believed by horny sailors to be mermaids, probably the origin of the mermaid legend. But it goes on and on. Aquatic mammals are among the few who play a lot as adults with each other. Dolphins play, otters play, humans play. I don't know if mice do. Of course, dogs and cats have been so long connected with humans that they're pretty playful as adults as well. I don't have a whole list of all of the ways that humans differ from the other primates. In fact, I'm realizing I should actually list them because for some time. I don't have it ready now. Because I recall there were about 75 ways, and 100% of them are explainable by the aquatic theory.
Wow. Well, going back to you said you had thought about this hours before Elaine Morgan did. What thought process got you started to thinking about it?
Okay, what started me thinking about this subject was a book called The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris. It was a big bestseller and actually one of the first books that really addressed the details of human evolution. But there were some parts of it that I just couldn't buy. And one of the major ones was about human female breasts. No other primate has that structure. They're all flat-chested. Desmond Morris said that he believed that they actually had developed for ornamentation to attract males, possibly to encourage pair bonding. Well, nature does do a lot of things in a lot of organisms to attract the opposite sex, but nature is economical. Those things that, say, for example, birds do, in that case it's the male to be attractive, it's just a matter of pigment. What they have is the colors. Even a peacock's tail is not really all that massive. But yet when you think about breasts, we're talking about a fairly large organ that takes a lot of food to produce. It's not biologically cheap. So I didn't quite realize why, but I knew that I hadn't bought Desmond Morris's theory. Well, one day, and now it's 41 years ago, I was with a few of my other friends back in those halcyon days of peace and love and the Whole Earth Catalog, and we were skinny dipping in a nearby creek. I noticed that Sandra's breasts were bobbing on the surface like a pair of pontoons. And I said, oh, my God, they float. She gives me a look. She says, yeah, boobs float. What do you expect? I said, well, no, this is why. This is why they exist, is for buoyancy. And she said, oh, I see you're a fan of Elaine Morgan. And I said, who? And she said, Elaine Morgan. She wrote a book called The Descent of Woman, in which she proposes the whole aquatic theory of human development. And so immediately I ran and started reading the stuff from Elaine Morgan and added quite a bit of information to the knowledge I already had about it. But boobs float. That was actually the beginning for me of the particular awareness, you know, that we obviously had some kind of force, some kind of selective pressure that had caused us to be really different from the other apes. Fat babies. When chimpanzee or gorilla or orangutan babies are born, they're skinny to the point of emaciation. Human babies are little fat butterballs. They bob around.
This is true.
Other things are the flexibility of our spine, very much like a seal. Also, the human sense of balance is highly refined. Being able to walk around totally erect with just these 2 feet underneath it requires a very, very acute sense of balance. Four-legged animals, they have their center of gravity in the middle of their body. So, and if you measured the point directly below that, you'd see it's right in the middle of the area covered by their 4 feet. They're really stable. Only by making continual little adjustments are we humans able to stand up. Interestingly enough, the first animal that comes to mind for most people when you talk about a mammal with a really good sense of balance are seals and sea lions. That's why they can balance balls on their noses. Not only can they balance themselves, but they can balance objects. I don't think I've seen anybody but humans or seals ever spinning a basketball like that.
Well, one animal that comes to mind is a bear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not, they can stand up and walk, but they're kind of cumbersome. But like us, they have that layer of fat. But I mean, they can train them to throw balls and things like that. Poor bears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
right, you are on the bears. As a matter of fact, they are one of the few terrestrial mammals that develops that same particular layer of fat, although in their case it's for hibernation. By the time spring comes, it's pretty much all gone.
Yeah, yeah.
More and more fossil evidence has shown up about the exact ancestry of the other animals that return to the sea. Like, you know, they found the intermediate organism between this terrestrial carnivore ancestor and modern-day whales. And dolphins. In fact, believe it or not, it was found in the Western Sahara Desert, of all the places to find fossil whales.
Wow.
Yeah. I have a list here of some of the characteristics. Hairlessness is one biggie. Now, Desmond Morris said, we became hairless because we needed to be able to not overheat when we were running through the savannah chasing game, things like that. But we also developed the ability to sweat, to cool ourselves. Well, if we developed our hairlessness on the savannah, we're the absolutely only animal who ever did. All the others, whether they're lions or cheetahs or leopards or, I don't know, wildebeest or gazelles or zebras, all have plenty of fur. They're completely furred. The only animals you'll find without hair, well, dolphins come to mind immediately, dolphins and whales.
Yeah.
Some, like sea lions, have very tight hairs that almost fit them like a second skin. And our hair follows a pattern of streamlining that if you look at just what little bit of hair we do have, the ends of the hairs point pretty much downward towards our feet in the direction that water would flow, providing the minimum, the least amount of resistance to motion through water.
So they're sort of, I mean, kind of aerodynamically designed, but yet for water.
Yeah, hydrodynamically designed, actually, would be the word, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I just couldn't think of the word.
Okay, well, you know, that's a nice thing about being a biologist. You learn how to make up words if you need them, as long as they follow the rules. Stereoscopic vision. We perceive 3D much, much better than, say, chimpanzees or gorillas or orangs or even the lesser apes like gibbons and baboons. And this would be something that would be very useful when we're living in an environment where only our heads are above water most of the time. So you don't get the same number of visual clues. You have to be able to just directly determine how far away some other individual is. We recognize each other mostly by facial features. Now, people, when describing somebody, will mention their general body type, but it comes out to being a fairly brief description. What we actually specifically identify people by is their faces. And, in fact, what we're determining, what characteristics we're seeing, are so numerous, they've never really been listed. I mean, there's been some attempt to analyze it, but just by description, not even a good police sketch artist can make a very good drawing of someone if they haven't seen the person that they're drawing. How do other animals identify each other? By smell.
Yeah.
But the places where they smell on us are underwater. And while fish can indeed smell underwater, air breathers like us can't. So we recognize each other by faces. We tend to communicate with words. Now, in, once again, case of, let's say, dogs or lions or wolves, most communication is like body language and facial language. And, if, well, you've got dogs, you know what it's like, how well attuned they are to exactly what you're feeling at a single glance.
Yeah.
And they do learn words from humans. But, okay, face language was available, but body language, once again, pretty useless when our bodies are underwater most of the time. In fact, it's generally supposed that we were actually wading animals more so than swimming. And in fact, there are a few aquatic monkeys that actually live on the sea, live at the seashore, and when danger threatens on land, they run into the water. When danger threatens in the water, like a shark, they go running back onto the land. But mostly, they're wading around. Our feet are perfectly designed to walk on sand. In fact, that's where the Birkenstock Company got their original idea from. They had people walk in sand, and then they measured the footprint that was left behind, and then based their sandals on that particular shape. It's where they got the negative heel from. There are actually two primates who do wade a lot. Bonobos live in a part of the jungle that floods seasonally, and they don't go run into another part of the jungle. They just hang out and wade around in the water until the waters recede. But maybe more significant is the proboscis monkey. Now, if you've ever seen a picture of one, they got a schnoz like Jimmy Durante, big, really big.
I haven't seen that.
The thing is, the proboscis monkey and humans have nostrils that point downwards. The nostrils on the other great apes point straight forward. A dog's or a cat's nostrils point forward. But imagine yourself swimming underwater, just, you know, breaststroking along as humans do, and you can see that the flow of water is down across your nose, and that if our nostrils pointed directly forward, they would have a tendency to have water forced into them.
Well, yeah.
So we have this adaptation, which is our long noses with downward pointing nostrils, just like the proboscis monkey. Probably the most aquatic of monkeys.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I wanted to know, Tom, what's the most compelling argument that convinced you that this theory is real?
Buoyancy.
Buoyancy.
Buoyant breast, buoyant babies, the fact that humans tend to develop fairly large pot bellies, which are murder on our spines, but in the water, they don't put any pressure on the spine at all. And in fact, the kind of fat bodies that most humans have, if they let themselves go, are very well adapted. So yeah, I would say the fat's probably most important. Although I have seen a number of others. The long hair, when women are pregnant, they develop this big, luxurious head of hair. And once again, Desmond Morris's attempt to explain it is that this is for attraction. This is because males find it gorgeous. Well, all dimorphisms look good to heterosexual males. I mean, anything that makes a woman look like a woman is going to be somewhat attractive. But hair is like all protein. And while a baby is developing inside a woman, her body really doesn't have a lot of substance to spare for just decoration. especially since that's the time when women least need to be sexually attractive. They're already pregnant. And yet the hair growth is really luxuriant. Well,
yeah.
Elaine Morgan suggests that the purpose of this was to give babies something to hang on to. And in fact, the young of other primates hang on to their mothers by clinging to their fur.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's another one. Sex. The most common human position gets called the missionary position. It's ventral-ventral, belly-to-belly. While all of the primates actually experiment with all, as many of the positions as they can, ventral-ventral, belly-to-belly is not very common. In fact, the only primate that seems to favor it, other than for humans, is the bonobo. And they actually do have some aquatic influence in their lives as well. The structure, the genital structure, this is a little bit harder to describe. It's not something that I went into in my paper, but some writers have made a big thing out of. Women are structured in such a way that they can sit on the sand without automatically having to worry about sand getting up inside of them. You know, there's sort of a separation, a space there. They're lifted up off of the surface they're sitting on. And another thing that has been suggested as being associated with the aquatic theory is female ejaculation. Now, I know only some women do this. For a long time, medical science claimed there was no such thing, that was imaginary. Oh, this is just stress incontinence. You're peeing yourself because you're so excited. But that doesn't fit with my experience and the analysis of people who are into tantric yoga, where they use the term amrita to describe this fluid that women excrete. Well, it's been pointed out that if we're walking around, wading around in water, we're in an environment that's not really particularly clean. You know, there are plenty of little organisms that would love to get in with us, and that one possible function of squirting is to wash away at least the external areas of the genitalia to prevent infection, to prevent too much foreign material from getting inside.
Yeah. That to me, that makes sense.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm just, you know, looking here at different dentition. We don't have teeth like the other primates. Now, baboons have big, long snouts like dogs almost, but almost all of the monkeys, you'll notice their face in the mouth area protrudes a certain amount. Chimpanzees kind of look like humans wearing a dust mask or something. It's called being prognathous. And that
One question I wanted to ask, don't all monkeys, apes, and primates, don't they have canines as well, the sharp, long canines?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Every one of them except humans. We still have them, but in a very greatly reduced size. That we're not equipped for hunting in terms of our mouth at all. Although what our teeth are very good for is eating things like shrimp or clams or even fish, you know, a lot of marine-type foods. We also have a need for nutrients that are normally only found in an aquatic environment. Vitamin E comes from fish. Now, there are a few vegetable sources that people have discovered. So you can go get vitamin E pills that are vegetarian. But in a natural diet, just, you know, eating food that's out there in the world, fish, the bony fish, are the only source. And in fact, specifically, the best source are the marine fish. We also have a need for a very large amount of omega-3 fatty acids.
Well, go ahead, because I have a that just brought up a question.
It's necessary for our brain development. The idea that fish is brain food turns out to be true. You know, if a kid doesn't get enough fish growing up, or if the mother doesn't eat enough fish during gestation, it could actually be, well, detrimental. I won't go so far as to say damaging, but detrimental to the kid's brain. I'm dying to know what you wanted to ask.
Well, the mention of fish and omega-3s and things like that, I was just curious if maybe this would explain the human brain development, why our brains are so much larger than other animals.
One reason, and it's the one that I think is the most important, our brains evolved to the size that they did because it was possible, because we had whatever we needed in order to produce those brains. Animals living on land didn't get enough omega-3s to do it, but we also need omega-6s, but they're actually fairly common in a marine environment as well. Actually, the best omega-6 source you'll find in the ocean would be squid. It's also why whales will go to great lengths to eat squid, because they have the appetite for it.
Yeah.
We go through a lot of water and salt. The amount of water and sodium chloride that we have to put into our system every day, especially if we're working, say, in a warm climate or Tennessee in the summer, we've got to continually drink water, and many people even have to take salt pills. You don't find other land animals, sweating like this at all. I mean, dogs sweat a little bit between their toe pads, and they exhale a certain amount of moisture when they pant, but they don't sweat. Pigs don't sweat. That's why they have to wallow in mud. But humans sweat like racehorses, to put it simply. In the case of a horse, though, that sweat that they break will happen right after they've been really out running hard, and then they'll break a sweat for a while until they cool down. But they still don't produce it in the kind of quantities that humans do.
Yeah.
So this is another nutritional thing that suggests the ocean, where there's no shortage of salt and no shortage, apparently, of water.
Yeah. Well, one other question I have, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right. What is neoteny?
Neoteny.
I'm glad. Yes, thank you. What is that?
Neoteny is the retaining of juvenile characteristics. For example, there's a kind of salamander called an axolotl, and if it doesn't get the right food, it exhibits neoteny. It never grows up. Baby termites are neotenous. For so long as they're licking the pheromone off their mother, they don't develop. They stay in the juvenile shape. Well, in the case of most primates, the babies look very much like human babies. They have flat faces and little stubby noses and kind of a chubby-cheeked look like humans. But as they develop, they become ever more prognathous. They end up with, like, big, almost wolf-like jaws in the case of baboons, whereas humans have retained that shorter face, smaller canines. That's another neotenous characteristic. The thing is, that's an explanation that a lot of people come up with, you know, because we are pretty clearly neotenous in a lot of ways. But that's not the why of how we evolved as we did. That's the how. That's the mechanism.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like there are biological mechanisms that will cause something to happen, but it's natural selection that decides whether those characteristics remain with the species or not. So from a natural selective point of view, neoteny doesn't even enter into the picture. It's just the mechanism by which we ended up attaining the form that we did.
Okay. Well, so is that important to the aquatic cape theory, or really has nothing to do with it, or
It's actually important to all theories of human evolution. But, it's there in all of the theories. It's not specifically aquatic, though.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people wonder why I get so excited about a theory like this. And I have been all my life. I mean, for over 40 years now, been a major proponent. Matter of fact, it was one of the things that caused a very deep connection between Oberon and Morning Glory Zell and myself. I mean, the first evening we spent together, I brought up the aquatic ape theory, and it was like I was a brother forever because they were already very much into it themselves. But the why of it is because it explains in totally natural, biological ways how we came to be what we are. You'll hear theologians all the time saying, man must be some sort of special creation because we have brains bigger than we even need. Why, we're able to figure out the structure of the universe. And so God gave us these brains, blah, 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 you know. And if you just look at the simple other theories of how we came to be, they really don't address these differences, including, among others, the big brain. Walking around in water, by the way, most of our body would be buoyed up by water, so it wouldn't be such a big labor to hold a head the size of a human head erect. And our heads are heavy.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've noticed.
Yeah, I think I was reading somewhere where it's maybe 10 pounds or a little more.
Yeah,
that's a lot
like
to hold
that
up with a little bitty neck like what we've got.
Yeah, it's one of our most powerful sets of muscles, by the way, is our neck muscles. Our neck muscles, I mean, pound for pound, you know, for an area that small, we've got an awful lot of strength there. There's one muscle that's even stronger, though. It's got nothing to do with the aquatic theory. That's our tongues. You know, our tongues are very, very highly developed muscle, mostly. So.
Yeah. Mercy. Well, it kind of makes me wonder, so there's people who oppose the aquatic ape theory. What reasons or why do these people oppose this theory?
I have never heard a good one. I mean, one very common one is, we don't need the aquatic theory. We've already got a theory. But they mostly come from a point of view of, don't confuse us with the fact our minds are made up, and that's that. They really don't have any evidence to the contrary. In fact, the more intelligent, or at least wiser, of the primatologists who still hold to the savanna theory are still very open to it. Desmond Morris himself, in a recent interview, said, this is a wonderful hypothesis. Seat of the pants, he doesn't think that it's so, but it has never been disproved and that it really requires serious attention. And this is a guy who made his entire career based on the alternative theory, which is the savanna theory, that we made all the changes we did because the land around us became more arid and we couldn't just swing from tree to tree anymore. We had to drop down onto the ground and run between trees. Savannah used to be called parkland, which describes it very well. It's like a city park, you know, like open lawns with trees every here and there. Well, a lot of the reason for this theory was because so many hominid fossils had been found in parts of Africa that are now savannah. And they just made the unwarranted assumption that it had always been that way. Now we're finding out that the savanna in most of Africa didn't appear until maybe 2-3 million years ago, possibly even more recently, and that at the time of the earliest hominids that we have fossils of, we're talking jungle. We're talking jungle, lakes, and ponds, you know, very wet, lush kind of environment.
Yeah.
The period from, about 15 million to about 5 million years ago, mostly Miocene, a little at a Pliocene. It's also described as the fossil gap because there are no fossil primates that have been found from during that period of time. Now, if we, our ancestors were living in water, the likelihood that remains would get fossilized is a lot less. I mean, it's like the scavengers in the ocean pick a body apart pretty quickly. And fossilization is actually an unusual event anyway. And I would be really happy if someday they did find some fossils that supported it. But this is the excuse that a lot of opponents of the theory will use. Well, you don't have any fossil evidence. Well, that's true. But, you know, there's an old saying, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Because there is no fossil evidence of any other ancestor of ours at this time. In fact, you go up to just about the beginning of the Miocene, and the only primates are monkeys. Just like, you know, little modern Capuchin monkeys or, oh, I don't know, Hanuman mongoose, like that. And then when fossils begin to reappear, kind of, end at a Pliocene, almost the beginning at a Pleistocene about 5 million years ago, then suddenly there are all kinds of apes, all of the known modern apes and a few extinct species. And in between the intermediates, there are no fossils.
Hmm.
So that's one of the reasons. But mostly I have yet to hear any compelling reason against it. And people will dig their heels in. Ideas die hard. I have been amazed at how fat-headed scientists can be. I mean, science is never supposed to be dogmatic. If you're being a good scientist, you listen to every new bit of information, see how it fits in. But while science isn't dogmatic, most scientists are. I mean, I remember a fellow teacher pounding on the desk and screaming, "The dinosaurs declined gradually!" Because that's what he'd been taught, and he was not about to accept that there was a sudden extinction as a result of a collision with an asteroid or a comet.
Even with the physical evidence I mean, it's a no-brainer that you can tell they went extinct pretty quick.
Yeah, it happened suddenly. There's remnants, you know, there's mineral traces, specifically the metal iridium, almost over the entire world in about in this half-inch thick layer of clay that's found just when the age of dinosaurs ends and the age of mammals comes in, from the Mesozoic to the Cenozoic. This iridium anomaly is found everywhere, and the only place it comes from is meteors. We have very, very, very little of it on Earth, and it may be what little we do have came from elsewhere. But, boy, he didn't want to hear it. I mean, that was not what he already believed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned something about long hair.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Well, tell me, of course, wait a minute now. I'm getting a little confused here. That's easy to do today for me. I'm sorry. That had to do with the babies hanging onto the long hair. There's nothing else about the long hair. Well, I mean, both the male and the female, we all both have the ability to grow long hair.
Yeah, although when it's left unchecked, women do grow a lot more of it, especially during pregnancy. Yeah,
okay.
More and longer hair throughout human history has been seen as a feminine characteristic. It's like if you look at pictures of ancient Egyptians, basically the men were expected to shave their heads, but women, if they were of the royal classes, were expected to grow their hair really long. Also,
Okay. Floating
hair might make a good handhold, even if it's daddy who's babysitting, if you're wading around in water.
Yeah, well, I was kind of wondering about the pairing, too, because there's, I'm trying to think of some of the animals that will pair up for life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not even humans pair up for life. I'm not even sure we're even built to pair for life. I know that eagles do.
Let's see. Wolves will generally maintain a monogamous relationship. The most common among the songbirds is, I don't know, what I call hillbilly monogamy. Monogamy with cheating. It's like songbirds pair off, and they only do it for a season. But for that season, what they both expect is that the other is going to be faithful to them. And it often doesn't happen. A female sees a male that she thinks is more attractive, she'll fly off with him for a little while, and the males will do the same thing. And frequently, you'll see where one member of a couple, like, say, sparrows, catches the other, and they raise holy hell and throw the eggs out of the nest and all sorts of things like this. But, you know, so there we got monogamy with cheating.
Yeah.
Swans are supposed to pair for life, but in a place called Isis Oasis, which is, it's like a country retreat center in California. The woman had a lot of animals, including a pair of English white swans and a pair of Australian black swans. And every spring they would do the mating dances with each other, and they would mate, and sometimes they'd lay fertile eggs, and sometimes they wouldn't. But then one day, don't know how it happened, both females died. Now, frequently when a swan's mate dies, the surviving one will just pine away, stop eating, stop living, and just basically real quickly go downhill, which humans sometimes do as well. But these two swans became a couple, both male.
Wow.
Two different colors, two different parts of the world, although definitely both swans. Every spring they did the mating dances. They did that thing where they rubbed their necks against each other. I don't know that one mounted the other any more often than, you know, the other way around. But so there's an animal that's seen as monogamous that, at least in this one case, it's not true at all.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, you know, I'm sitting here trying to kind of process everything you're talking about. I'm sorry for just throwing things out, but one thing that came to mind with all of this is I can't remember how many years back when they started birthing babies underwater. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Charles LeBoyer.
Yes. But, you know, I remember watching some videos of babies birthed underwater. They came out and were just naturally able to swim. And with my own son, I was so intrigued by that. He wasn't even a month old, and I put him in a pool. And, of course, I would go under the water and watch him, you know, because I didn't want him to drown. But, you know, but I would let him down in the water, and he would just naturally, you know, hold his breath, and he would just be paddling his little feet and arms, and he's not known a day where he didn't know how to swim.
It really delights me to hear that from you. I didn't know that about you, that you had actually done it. It has been observed before, way back when, early 50s, there used to be a TV show called You Asked for It, and people would write in requesting that they put things on the show that they had found interesting, and one of them was about babies in the water who were introduced to it soon after they were born, just swimming around with all the ability of like a baby seal or a baby otter, not drowning, holding their breath as soon as they were underwater, opening their eyes so they could see where they were going.
Yes.
The LeBoyer babies that were born in water pretty much seemed to know how to swim instinctively. And more recently, there was a Russian scientist, Charkovsky, who also was introducing babies to water as soon as they were born. In fact, his two daughters both did LaBoye births underwater and then stayed in this heated indoor pool for the next several months with their babies. And there was never any complication. In fact, they said it was amazing. The kids would climb out and dive back into the water, just whooping it up and having a wonderful time.
Yeah, I mean, my son was, well, he was born in Jacksonville, Florida. We lived on the beach. And like I said, he's about 2 weeks old when I put him into the water. And what fascinated me was that I would come up and under him, and I would pick him up, bring him out of the water, and he would giggle. I mean, he'd just giggle. And I'd lower him back in ever so slowly up to his chin, and then he would just go buoyant, and I'd go under, and his eyes were always open. Of course, this was a non-chlorinated pool.
You asked earlier what I thought was the most important bit of evidence. I think more than fat, I think it's the one that you've just brought up. The ability of babies to swim and to be completely at ease in water as soon as they're born.
Yeah.
I think that might be the most important indication. And it's been done other places. You know, in Sweden they had, for a while, it was, they called it the baby swim fad. And, you know, every kids were brought to the pools when they were a couple of weeks old, and then mothers went swimming with their babies. So here's another country where it was done and with great success. Yeah, that might be, I think, the more I think of it, the biggest indication. That and the fact that we love water. I mean, where do people vacation? They go to the beach or they go to the lake up in the mountains.
Exactly.
But, yeah. And I don't know of any other animal that's really terrestrial who likes water. I know there's always exceptions, but for the most part, dogs would rather not, and cats absolutely hate it. They're able to swim, but they don't like getting wet.
Well, cats don't have a lot of fat on their body either. Have you noticed that?
I couldn't prove it by my cat.
Well,
most of them don't. My kitty here is getting real pointy.
Well, mine is too as it gets older. But also, we're feeding them, you know, canned cat food and people food and things like that. But out in the wild, they eat rabbits and just all kinds of lean things, and left to nature, they have very little fat.
Boy, that is so true. Yeah, left to their own devices, the mice and stuff they catch don't have very much fat on them for the cat to take in. They get almost no carbs, which we also convert to fat. Boy, that is really right on. In fact, that's one of the things that was very well known to a lot of Native Americans, that if you want to get meat that has much fat, you got to kill them at the end of the summer and preserve it, because by the time you're well into the winter, all of the game animals are down to like zero fat.
Yeah, that's where. But now, groundhog is one animal that has, I mean, it's just about nothing but fat, and it's a vegetarian.
Now that you mention it, they just look like little waddling balls. They almost like they're sort of a rolling kind of gait. Yeah, we have one lives out underneath the barn. My brother David got bitten by a groundhog when we were kids. That's where he got the nickname
goodness.
Nature Boy, huh?
I said, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he thought, oh, boy, this groundhog isn't even running away. He sure is friendly, and he picks him up, and the groundhog bites him.
Oh, mercy.
You know, another one that other people bring up, what they call loss of estrus, which is about the only way, I guess, to describe it. Most mammals have an estrus cycle. They go into heat twice a year.
Yeah.
Whereas in the case of humans are never out of heat. The same cycle happens again and again and again, and it's almost like full-time mating. Although Sarah Hurdy, the primatologist, said it's not really full-time. It's situation-dependent. You know, it depends on what kind of quality a male is around. But there's no season. And I'm not exactly sure how that ties in with the aquatic theory, but I've heard a few people mentioning it.
Well, I kind of wonder, you know, especially with the fat development,
mm-hmm.
as females age, of course, we quit we have lack of hormone, you know, so, and we get fat. So maybe we're just meant to be islands out in the water.
May well be, just kind of bobbing around like corks or something.
That's right. Well, you know.
Yeah, this reminds me of something that I just read recently that might be very important in recent human evolution. You know, last 100,000 years, the time of the creative explosion among Necromanyons, our longevity seems to have increased very dramatically. And for the first time, about 30,000 years ago, most people had grandparents. The parents would pass the age at which they were, well, when women would pass the childbearing age, it's not much longer after that, men don't produce that much in the way of viable sperm. And generally, most animals, then they die. That's it. They've done their job biologically. But humans have a lot more years to go, and we have had for, well, roughly 30,000 years. And
yeah.
That whole thing of having a phase in our life that's that later phase that's not very physically strong, tending towards fat, but yet holding a lot of wisdom. I mean, it's like there is a certain amount of wisdom that comes with age for almost everybody, I think. Almost.
Yeah. Well, almost, yeah.
And so it's a way that humans could pass on more abstract ideas. You know, it's like those that were of parent age were running around mating, trying to survive, running away from predators, catching food, things like that. And really didn't have any leisure. Their time was pretty much used up by the kids. But then the next, you know, the older generation is there, and they tend to have a lot of time. And this may well be where the earliest artists and shamans and like that came from. Elders, huh?
That would make sense, too. Plus, if you have a lot of children, you know, to take care of, there again is extra people to help rear up children. You know,
exactly.
Sort of the village idea.
In the case of wolves, they have aunts and uncles who act as babysitters. But you have to have grandparents who can take care of the kids who don't need to be constantly dealt with, but still you have to keep an eye on them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot that lends to the theory rather than knocking it down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people may have bigger egos than brains. They need to eat more fish.
Yeah. This, by the way, reminds me of something else. There are motions that you see babies make, one of which it's, okay, if a baby was standing up, it would look like it's slapping its hands on a table or something, you know, starting with the hands over their head and then both hands together making this sort of downward slap and ending up, well, beyond straight out from their body, maybe swinging it through 180 degrees.
Well, yeah.
In water,
but even when they're laying down, their little hands are going down and they're kicking their feet all at the same time. That's treading water.
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what all of those motions are. And in fact, well, you saw with your own kid that he actually was treading water, using his hands and stuff in those ways.
Yeah. It's just his little belly. I mean, when my son's born, he was born by cesarean section.
Mm-hmm.
And so his head wasn't squeezed or anything. He just come out, he was mainly head, a good-sized belly, and being as he was a little fella, he was a lot of nuts, too. That's just the way it was. I think he had everything that he needed, you know. But to put him in water and to watch him, it was fascinating to me. And And still till this day, I mean, if he gets close to water, he's in it. And he's 31 years old.
Yeah, that seems to be true for anybody who wasn't kept away from water, you know, who had the opportunity. I'm sure that, like, Hawaiians and Samoans and all of that, because they're almost, it's almost as if they were born into the water. They swim from very early childhood, and most of their food comes from, well, what they can net near the shore. And
yeah.
Also, these are people who have a tendency to be very fat, because it's not doing them any harm in the water. It's only doing us harm when we try to walk around on our hind legs out here with nothing else holding us up.
Yeah. I know I'm much more comfortable in the water than I am on land, you know. I mean, I'm a big woman, and I spent most of my life in the water, as a matter of fact. A good portion of my younger days were in the water.
You know, I've noticed that especially women who are somewhat fat look so graceful in the water. You know, they move with this fluidity which they never would on land.
Yeah.
You know, I think that might be another indication there.
Yeah, I mean, I can do things in the water such as playing volleyball that I cannot do on land at all. And it wasn't too long, well, last summer or the summer before, my husband and I were over at a friend's house in a pool, and I was playing a game of volleyball. He just kept looking at me. He says, "Isn't that hurting you?" And I said, "Not at all. I'm having a blast."
I can almost see it. You know,
when I
like,
got out, it was hard to walk when I got out, you know.
Well, I remember that, too. When you get out from swimming, you feel like you weigh a ton. Like you're trying to carry lead bricks around with you or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in the water feels much more natural.
It sure does.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting down toward the end of the program. Is there anything else you wanted to say, Tom?
I'm checking my notes here to see if there is anything that would be really important that I left out. Yeah, I know it's the reason I get so excited about it is, first off, I'm excited about evolution generally. The idea of a creator God just doesn't float with me, and basically I'm solid pagan. And evolution is a process spread out over time that's very much like the birth process. Everybody has a mother. Individuals give rise to other individuals, and they change over time, but we all came from somewhere. We didn't just get all handcrafted and put together by a craftsman like God somewhere. And in fact, there are things about us that are not really perfect for the way we live. I mean, we all develop back problems as we age because we're trying to hold ourselves in a position that's kind of unnatural.
Yeah.
So, in fact, and we sag. I mean, all of our parts sag. And none of them would if we were in water.
Oh, this is true. Well, that's the show for tonight, folks. And, Tom, we thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Hope to have you on again.
Okay.
And for our guest next week is going to be Kira Withers.
Mm-hmm.
She was shot at recently while sitting in her home, and the mm-hmm. person who shot at her yelled witch as they passed by. So we're going to talk next week with her on that experience, and we hope to have you on listening then.
Okay, well, I will be actually listening.
All right. Good night, Tom.
Good night. And bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hi, welcome everybody. This is Rick Wilson with Screen the News, and tonight I've got my esteemed guest, Evan Batterton.
Tonight, how are you doing, Rick?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh, great. I got a big glass of water. We got a lot to talk about.
We do. Tonight's subject's going to be GMOs. And for folks that are not familiar with that acronym, it's genetically modified organisms. Evan and I have done a couple different shows. And just for those wanting to know, next week we will also be discussing RFID implants. That's April 11th. A week from today, and then a week later on April 18th, we will be discussing chemtrails with Madison Star Moon. But tonight we are going to be concentrating on GMOs. You can reach me, Rick Wilson, at Screen the News on Facebook. Just type in Screen the News. You will find the site. And I highly recommend everyone to check out Evan Batterton's work. He has done amazing work. Done a lot of writing, gotten a lot of accolades with the information that he's providing recently. And you can reach him at Evan Batterton, which is evanbatterton.wordpress.com. And right. Evan, you had recently, I know you've written a little bit about this before. I know you've had interest in GMOs. As we all do, I think it's a hot topic. I don't know where you want to begin, but just for myself, I've kind of been clueless to this sort of thing. You know, I heard back, you know, what in the 80s with Tab, with NutraSweet, and things like that things were being added and were being tested on rats and put in our food. And the adverse effects that can come about from those things. Now, what's been your experience that got you interested in GMOs, which is, you know, genetically modified organisms in our food supply? Because I know that you have a food industry background, and I know
right.
you're passionate about it.
Right. Well, you know, I've been cooking for a long time. You know, ever since I was a kid, we're talking single digits, raised by my grandparents and taught to cook. And, you know, we grew our own vegetables. You know, we had a garden, and it wasn't a yard. There was no yard. It was all food. You know, that was for dual purposes. You know, one was we wanted to go as natural as possible, and the other part is it saved money. We tried to be as, you know, self-sufficient as humanly possible. But as far as, you know, my background in food, you know, I eventually went to a culinary arts school. I went to Le Cordon Bleu in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. It was a great school. And I had a nutrition teacher. Nutrition's mandatory. It was mandatory as part of the program, and she was really ahead of her time. And, you know, really knew, she just knew a whole lot about GMOs and about, and was warning us ahead of time, you know, this is something you're going to see in the next 10 years. It's really going to, it's going to get big. It's going to invade, you know, the market completely. It's going to take over. And, you know, the name that she kept throwing around was Monsanto. And that's the name that, you know, everybody in our movement in the various, branches, whether it's anonymous or independent people or the exec group or anybody, everybody knows about Monsanto, and the general consensus is that's, you know, the most evil corporation in the whole world. And, you mentioned NutraSweet back in the 80s. You know, that actually happened in the 60s by accident. There was a chemist named James Slaughter, and he was working for the G.D. Searle company, and he was testing an anti-ulcer drug. So if you think about it, these artificial sweeteners that really technically they're called aspartame, and you and I had spoken before that we were going to, you know, make it clear to everybody that aspartame is so big, you know, it is so dangerous. It is probably the most dangerous genetically modified organism in our food, because GMOs can be anything, animals, you know, you name it. It's any organism that's you know, genetically modified, basically. But as far as food go, aspartame is so dangerous, and it's so prolific, and it targets our children first and foremost, because it's found mostly in, you know, these powdered juices and things like that. And people just need to keep in mind that this, you know, every time they open up a packet of NutraSweet or
Evan, on that, I read an article recently that said that pretty much every, you know, non-sweetened, non-sugared gum contains aspartame, and pretty much any diet soda contains aspartame.
Right, and that's a huge problem, because that means that aspartame is being peddled as a healthy alternative. Okay, and what aspartame actually does, and like I said, this isn't food, okay? This is an anti-ulcer drug. This was an experimental anti-ulcer drug back in the 60s that was discovered by accident that just so happened to be sweet. And now it's being put in everything. And what it does is it damages the neurons in the brain. And so what you're seeing is, with a lot of these studies, is, you know, in these food additives that use aspartame, you're seeing everything from migraines to insomnia to tachycardia to anxiety attacks, slurred speech. There's been links to ADD, ADHD.
ADHD. I think, wasn't there someone in Europe, I think it was either France or I want to say Belgium, that linked it directly to cancer.
Sure. All these genetically modified organisms in our food, they have a wide range of attacks. It's really what I like to call a scorched earth method.
I see recently, gentlemen, that they're going to be putting it in milk.
Yes, that is a new thing too. That's a new thing also.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you think about it, it's the two main things that it's in are the main staples across the planet: rice and corn. I mean, those are the main staple foods across the planet. Those are the most widely consumed foods. And now they're putting it in milk.
In rice now, in Kansas. Have you read about that? Yeah.
I've heard about that. And, you know, but another thing, too, I mean, if we're going to talk about milk, one thing that they've been doing in China for a while now, if you really want to get on the perverse side of genetically modified organisms, is they've been splicing human genes into the cows in China, so the cows are giving human breast milk. I mean, that's just one of the more perverse sides and more extreme sides of genetically modified organisms. And that's so new, we don't even know what that does. And maybe it doesn't do anything, but, you know, I would bet the farm that it does.
Well, being devil's advocate, though, too, Evan and Ruthann, you know, I'd like to say, you know, looking at the opposite side, so if they're splicing human genes and providing breast milk through cows that way, could that not be a good thing? I mean, is Monsanto then?
It's a gamble, Rick, because there's no data. There's no data.
Well, that's also true. Plus, well, I'm a vegan, and I'm very, very healthy. I don't do animal products, and there's no reason for us to. So, no, I think it's really, just part of.
Yeah, and what's the control group? What's the control group in this experiment, guys, if we don't have any data? I mean, breast milk goes to what? Babies.
The control group is children.
Yeah, we're given something that we have no data, really no long. And you know how the Chinese are. I mean, I'm not trying to diss the Chinese, but I mean, as a people, but you know, their environmental standards are much lower. They're very industrious. Okay, they're all about advancement at whatever cost. You know, they could lose half a billion people and still remain strong. You know, so it's to them they're going to keep on trekking. They're going to forge ahead. So what we have here is, you know, here in America, they're going to start putting, you know, whatever, you know, the aspartame, you know, and you, who knows, or maybe they'll call it vanilla milk, and we're probably going to see cinnamon milk, but it's all going to be aspartame. Okay, and it's all going to be, you know, it's like you said, Rick, it's cancer-causing, but it attacks the neurons in the brain. You know, it can cause strokes, like I said, tachycardia, you name it. Okay, this is really, really poisonous stuff. And, you know, like you and I discussed before, this is something that we could talk about aspartame for a long time. It's so poisonous. But Monsanto does get the credit for aspartame as well. And going back, in, it seems like, you know, milk is really the root of all this. Monsanto,
well, aren't
genetically
they even,
modified
aren't they
organisms.
Even, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Evan. Aren't they even, there was a new thing I was researching where homogenized milk compared to non-homogenized and how, you know, how it affects the farmers, how it has to basically go through sort of a Monsanto paradigm, if you will, or curriculum.
Yeah.
And they're attacking, you know, just natural resources. So even natural farmers, farmers markets, and so forth, where they are trying to control the entire food market. And this is one of those things, folks, too. I mean, I try to keep my temperament. We talk about a lot of, you know, non-mainstream news issues. But this is one that I'm very, very passionate about because we, as far as I'm concerned, I like to keep a level head. I like to look at extremes and look, you know, devil's advocacy in different ways. But as far as I'm concerned, as far as the research I've done, especially after reading some of the work that you've done, Evan, I know, Ruth Ann, you're on board with this too, is that I'm incensed, and we're being poisoned. And what can we do to look out for these kinds of things? If it's in rice, if it's in corn, does that mean we can't go buy, you know, a can of corn at the store? Because there was a big push, you know, recently in California, there was over, you know, $45 million spent by Monsanto to not label their own, the fact that they had genetically modified organisms in food. So if they have a good product, why would they be spending so much money to not label it?
Right.
If they had a great vitamin, they would say, hey, check us out.
Well, their reasoning behind it, and if, you know, this is why we talk about it, and this is why it's considered alternative media. We can't be bought by them, okay? That's why we talk about it, and that's why it angers us. Politicians can be bought.
Right.
And so what happened in California was, is you had the population was definitely against it. I think that vote was a farce. I think it was a complete farce. I think it absolutely was voted in favor of labeling, and I think it was just, you know, they cooked the books on that one, I really do. I think they cooked the books, and their whole point was, is, you know, it's going to cost an extra 37 cents per product to add a GMO label, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, as far as what we can do, I mean, it's important. We got to understand first how they're fighting us and how they're killing us. We know that they're poisoning us, okay? But how are they getting by with it, and has there been any victories? Okay, now there has been victories, more so around the world than there has been in America. You know, there's everybody saying that, you know, Russia has banned, you know, Monsanto and GMOs, and there's all these memes on Facebook and social media and Twitter, but a lot of those things are incorrect, Rick. They're not entirely true. The truth is, with Russia, is all they did was ban the importation of GMO corn from the United States. There's still genetically modified organisms on every single country on the. It's in every single country on the planet, in the food supply. It's just that other countries are focusing on. They're not allowing it to have total control like the United States does. But people are fighting back in the States. It's because we're getting smarter. There is a portion of the population, us, people like us, that we're spreading the word and we're pointing it out. And there's people like Ruth Ann, who's, you know, you said you were a vegan. I mean, is for me as a chef, is being a vegan as fun as eating a big steak? You know, maybe it's not as fun, but, you know, I can tell you right now, for me, you know, I've done. I've done it before, and I felt way, way, way better.
Oh, yeah.
And it, I mean, like, miraculously better. So one of the things we can do is just we have an option. Are we going to poison ourselves or not? And
well, how can we label them, though? This is the biggest thing for me.
We can,
okay?
Rick.
And you mentioned,
we can.
Like, well, I think we can. I think there's ways around this, okay? You mentioned that you know, the alternative is, well, it would have to cost an extra 32 cents to label. And I know that was just one term, but I know that that's
right.
Completely incorrect.
That's crap.
That's,
yeah,
like
crap.
Saying, that's yeah. Like, because everything that you buy lists how much niacin, vitamin A, vitamin B, riboflavin, you know, salt
mm-hmm.
content, it would cost less than one penny per whatever it was to label that. So,
right.
So the fact that they're not labeling that is one thing. One thing that I have noticed, and I saw this once, this is like a month and a half ago, and I saw this on memes on some social media sites, Facebook and Twitter. It was very interesting where people, there's some companies, I wish I would have brought them up, and I don't recommend this because I never recommend to break the law or to incite violence or threats or anything like that, but I actually did see on a couple boxes of cornflakes where someone had taken it upon themselves to say this contains GMO. So in other words, this wasn't
mm-hmm.
the Safeway store itself. It was people going in and labeling that. Now, I think there's ways around that. If we contact our congresspeople, how effective would that be just to label? I mean, that's all we're asking for, right? At least label it. We all have choices. We all make good choices. We all make bad choices. If I know something contains too much sodium and I want sodium, I might overdo it. But at least I know that that's what's contained in whatever I'm consuming. What do you both think is a solution to this?
Well,
I didn't work in California.
If it was me, I wouldn't fight. I wouldn't use congressmen to fight. I would not use politicians. I would use a completely different set of evil that sells out for money, and I'd go with lawyers. I would absolutely go with lawyers, and I'm going to tell you why. I mean, a lot of people know that I'm from St. Louis. I'm sitting right here in the Central West End in St. Louis, and there was a huge victory against Monsanto. We have a Monsanto office here in St. Louis, and one of the ways that Monsanto has been so successful is they've been charging, you know, royalties against farmers because their seeds are not self-sustainable.
Well,
can
you explain that? Can you explain that? What does that mean to farmers?
Well,
is that crippling
basically
farmers? Basically,
every year they have to buy brand new seeds. They cannot use the seeds from the previous year's crops to re-sow their fields. They have to go back to Monsanto and buy more seeds.
Yep.
And so they're continually having to buy from them. So there's no longer any kind of independence in farming. They're making it completely where everybody has to depend on them. Now, when you have organic farmers, this is how Monsanto's screwing them, and this is what happened in St. Louis, how they got a victory over them. What happens is the seeds will blow from Monsanto crops into organic crops, and then those seeds will fuse, and the DNA starts to bond with those plants. And Monsanto knows this. They know what they're doing. They know the direction that the winds blow in, and they do this on purpose. And what they'll do is they'll sue these organic farmers for copyright infringement. So they patent their seeds, and they sue them for copyright infringement.
So the farmers have no choice at that point.
They have no choice. So what they did here in St. Louis is they did a, you know, a preeminent attack, and they sued Monsanto before they could sue them for copyright infringement for corrupting their crops with their genetically modified seeds, and they won. They won.
Well,
and
that should have been mainstream news. It wasn't.
It wasn't. It was the biggest. The biggest that did was the St. Louis Business Journal. And St. Louis is, you know, one of the biggest cities in the country, you know, and it's one of the oldest and most and has a rich history. And it's the second biggest tourist town in the country, believe it or not, because of all the free things that the city offers. And there's a Monsanto office here, and these farmers won a huge suit against them, a landmark that could be used as case law. I mean, this is case law we're talking about, Rick. I mean, other farmers can go and use this as an example.
Yeah, but Evan, how effective do you think that'll? Do you think this is sort of a straw man victory? Where
it is now, as of the 26th.
It's just a short term victory.
Well,
that,
I mean, we know what happened on the 26th through the Monsanto Protection Act. That when everybody was hooked on CNN and the gay marriage,
actually,
that got passed through.
I have to interrupt you there, Evan, and Ruth, and you can probably jump in here. No one really knew about the Monsanto Protection Act because there seemed to be a huge push on the gay-lesbian issue for some reason.
Right.
And secretly, quietly, that act was put into place.
Yes,
if one of you wants to explain what that act is, that would be great.
Well, Ruthann, I mean, do you want to take this? I mean, I know a little bit about it. I know that it has, you know, five provisions that really, really hurt, that really, really, really hurts the public in terms of fighting Monsanto. But the biggest thing is that there can be no, that the Supreme Court can't stop any kind of banning on GMO products of any kind. And it was, you know, lobbied by, it was, you know, it was pushed through by Monsanto lobbyists.
With all their money, yes, and they've got a lot.
Yeah, and in 2012, guys, their CEO was named CEO of the Year.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that tells you anything, but, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when we mentioned the other night, Rick, about Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize, I mean, it's kind of a joke. It's kind of a joke. It's just really a farce. I mean, it seems like the more evil people are, and the more they get pushed.
Wait, are you saying Monsanto's CEO was labeled CEO of the Year?
Yeah, he was CEO of the Year 2012.
Well, and
I
want to get to this too. You know, when we're talking about this, and we're talking about GMOs and so forth, I'm not trying to really scare people too much to death, but again, as I prefaced before, there's certain things that we talk about. This one, I really, really want people to understand. This stuff is in your baby formula. This stuff is in your kid's food. So the FDA is really involved. It's not just Monsanto. Just so people know, Obama appointed Monsanto's vice president as senior advisor to the FDA, Michael Taylor. And this is like this is sort of a cookie cutter thing that's been happening with the FDA over recent years. Some people go, "Oh, you can trust the FDA." I'm not going to be all conspiratorial and say, "No, you can't trust everything they do," but you can do the research, and they're very fallible. As far as if you look at who was appointed to high positions in the FDA, they will come from companies like Monsanto. That just happened.
And you know what? His name's Michael Taylor. His name's Michael Taylor. Everybody should Google him and write him a nasty letter. That was unethical on a scale that, I mean, Obama might as well have spit in our faces. Okay, and this is not an attack on Obama. You know, this is not an attack on the Democratic Party because Romney supported Monsanto as well. Okay, this is not us taking sides politically. This is us pointing out that the powers to be, you know, they're in bed with Monsanto.
In office, he would have done the same thing.
He would have done the exact same thing. And Rumsfeld, he sat on their board of directors. Justice Thomas of the Supreme Court was a lawyer for Monsanto. John Ashcroft accepted campaign funds when he ran for
now,
governor.
When you
right
say
here
Justice Thomas, you mean Clarence Thomas? Because I know that
Clarence,
he was
yep.
a board member of Monsanto, and when they're ruling on these cases, how is that not? You know.
Well, typically, you know, I mean, in circuit courts and things like that, whether it's civil or criminal cases, if a judge had a conflict of interest, he would recuse his position. And I don't know if. I don't think that a Supreme Court judge can do that. I really don't think because they have to have a certain, you know, they have to maintain that number to vote on. But, you know, the whole point of them, the whole point of appointing a Supreme Court judge is that no matter what his or her background was, that they are so honorable, if you will, and this is why they get the lifetime appointment. They're so honorable that it doesn't really matter what they used to do. That they're that honorable that we can count on them to be completely ethical every single time. And that's just impossible. That's implying that they're perfect. Okay, that's implying that they're inhuman. And you can't tell me that a man that grew rich off of the same company that brought us Agent Orange and Roundup.
And when you say that, Agent Orange and Roundup, Evan is referring to Monsanto.
Yeah, Monsanto brought us Agent Orange, and they brought us Roundup, and they fused Roundup with our corn. The problem with the GMOs with Monsanto, besides aspartame, is we're eating vegetables that have built-in pesticides.
Yeah.
Evan, are you suggesting, Evan, that there's a conflict of interest with Clarence Thomas making all this money and being a former board member of Monsanto
Conflict of interest for 20 years.
All the way.
Yeah, there's been a conflict of interest for 20 years in the entire government with Monsanto. It's in every branch, Rick. We see it with Obama there as executive. We see it with his cabinet. We've seen it with Bush's cabinet members. We've seen it in
all these czars. Food czars. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Mike Taylor started. He was appointed as the food czar, and then Obama, promoted him via presidential appointment to the senior advisor to the commissioner. So basically, he's kind of like the Karl Rove to the FDA, and he was a vice president for Monsanto. I mean, come on. How unethical. Unethical.
We both have research, and I know, Rusa, and you have too. Okay, and I wanted to bring up WHO, World Health Organization. Just mention these things just so people can research. UN, United Nations, Agenda 21, Codex Alimentarius. Just type in Codex and then ALIM and you'll find it. Some great research by Naomi Wolf, who talks about this push for this food control. And this has been around for a long time. Now, and I think at least me and Evan are, Ruth, and I think you are too, that politically we understand it doesn't really matter who's in office, whether it's Obama or Romney or what have you. It's sort of a corporatocracy. Monsanto is one of those corporate entities. Now, people are talking about banks and all that. That's a whole other issue, who's really controlling what's going on. And if you want to get deeper, which I don't think we have time for, Monsanto, you can link that back to bankers as well. But how important it is for people to know this is sort of like I refer it to a boiling frog parable. And what I mean by that, if you're not familiar with that parable, is that you put a frog in a dish of water at room temperature and you slowly heat up the water and just enough where the frog is still comfortable in that. It never jumps out until it boils to death. And the reason I say that, I hate to be scary about it, but this is something I'm very passionate about. These GMOs, baby formula, every food that your child eats, what you eat, everything goes into it. If this company is going to do what it wants to do with the money that it has, we'll end up controlling, 90% of our food population? So if they make a mistake, one mistake, let's say that they have every great intention, which I think we would agree they probably do not, but let's say that, do, if they make one mistake, then what happens? That's why I'm very passionate about this, and people really need to wake up to this.
The other side,
they
do.
Well,
if they make one mistake, because we have these agri-farms now, it used to be a small farmer rotated his crops like his neighbor did, but now with the agri-farms, that's all they grow. Thousands and thousands and thousands of acres, and the pests are getting... They're mutating. So when they take out corn, for instance, what are we all going to do, GMO'd or not? There will be no corn. Because this is, what's happening when you have great sections just devoted and you keep putting pesticides on the ground, you keep planting the same thing, and it's not wise stewardship of the land to begin with.
No, it's nutrient stripping for starters, and it's like what Ruth Ann said. I mean, I think I heard her mention, pests and pesticides. We got bugs that are mutating, but Monsanto, this is another thing important to point out. they have personally taken up the quest to genetically modify the honeybee because the honeybee, for whatever reason, is being wiped out.
I was just going to bring up the bees. When the bees die out, we will die out. I don't know if that was Mark Twain or
yeah,
who it was.
Einstein said that. Einstein said that. So they're genetically modifying bees, but it, you know, one thing that a lot of people don't understand is, like, you know, there's certain viruses in plants that, you know, that normally wouldn't affect us. Okay, so when we start playing around with them, like there's certain, like, cauliflower is a good example of one. It contains I can't remember what it is. I'll have to come back to that. But anyways, what's happening is we got viruses that normally wouldn't affect us that are mutating also.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also been some studies that these pesticides and some of these spliced organisms into the food are getting into our intestinal flora, and they're starting to grow. Some of the organisms are. And the other study that was worrisome, that points to the whole eugenics conspiracy theory that they're trying to wipe us out in three generations, was the rat study, where it eroded the testicles of the rats. Genetically modified food did, and by the third generation, the rats were completely sterile.
Mm-hmm.
So they were not able to reproduce whatsoever. I mean, this is a complete scorched earth method, and it's like you said, Rick. It's in the formula. It's in everything. It's in everything. And guys, everybody listening, this is about land grab. This is about food speculation. You know, banks controlling the world is one thing, but if you had to pick one thing that could control people as powerfully as money, what would it be? Food. You know, that's the other thing that's just as powerful as money that motivates people is food. You know, the will to survive. You know, it matches up with greed, you know, pound for pound, punch for punch.
And that's what I wanted to say, too, Evan, before, too, and Ruth Ann, is kind of what I was getting to, is that let's say that that we are incorrect with the research that we've done. Let's say that Monsanto is the new... I don't even know how to say it. Golden swan. It's right. Perfect. Even if that's the case, if they control, and their goal is to control this, and everything that we're talking about is documented, and again, you can check this out, what we're talking about later on Evan's blogs and on my page on Screen the News on Facebook, is even if they have the great intentions, it just takes a couple of mistakes to have a monopoly on the food supply. Forget money. Money is
right.
Irrelevant. Like you just said, Evan, money is irrelevant if you can't feed yourself and your family. And if all you're feeding yourself and your family is poison, and I hate to use that term, like everything we're eating is poison, but that's how serious I am about it. And if you do the research, it points
roughly
to
roughly 60% of our food in America is genetically modified, and we don't know what it is because it's not labeled. Ruth Ann's probably got the right idea with her diet. I mean, you're safer if it's not in a box or in a can, okay,
yeah.
or comes from the freezer section. Try and get organic produce and things like that. If you're going to eat meat, you know, see if you can, you know, find a butcher that, you know, that's untreated. There hasn't been hormone injections. You know, things like that. I mean, she's got the right idea. You know, it's one of those things to where, like, if your food doesn't go bad, if it doesn't go bad in 3 or 4 days, then it's bad for you.
You need it.
yeah. It's bad for you if it doesn't go bad. If it doesn't go bad, it's bad for you. So, I mean, we look at things like cucumbers and onions, and I think cucumbers are like the number fourth most cultivated vegetable in the world or something like that. And we look at corn and we look at rice and all that. And those are, you know, cornmeal, polenta is a staple in Africa. Rice is a staple of China and Asia. And we're talking about food staples, you know, so we got, I think the top GMO crops are, what is it, soy, tomatoes, corn and rice. Those are your top crops. And soy is it's an aspartame thing. You know, it's being promoted as a healthy alternative.
As well, it has been for years.
Yeah, as the healthy alternative, but this whole time it's been it's infected with pesticides. You're swallowing pesticides. You
well,
are.
On that
I
too,
mean,
Evan, when you're talking about going through the produce section of the market, now there's controversy over this too. The PLU codes or the SKU codes, the codes when you're going buying vegetables and fruits, there's certain things that you can look for. So.
Mm-hmm.
If it starts with a 4, it's organic. If it starts
right.
with a 9, I'm sorry, if it's a 4, it's conventional. If it starts with a 9, it's organic. If it starts with an 8, it's genetically modified. Now, of course, there's a lot of controversy on how those codes and stickers are put on fruit and vegetables and so forth, but I think that's
and people, everybody
people
listening,
to
needs to Google
of.
What you just said too. They need to Google what you just said and write those numbers down. That's really important what you just said, Rick. It needs to be written down. It does. I mean, because there's no way of knowing. And there are certain vegetables like beets, for example. If you got beets that are heavily sprayed and they're not organic, you know the way they grow, you know it just there's just a really high concentration of poison. That sits right on top of the beet, just because of its physiology, the way that it is.
Now,
do either one
of you know about this? I'm sorry again. I'm so passionate about this because it's something that you know I don't want to get too emotional about. Like I said, I'm usually very even tempered, but when people are buying baby formula, you know, what do parents do? Their kids, and when, you know, even older kids that go to school and what's being fed to them, even when they're packing their lunches and you're buying baby formula, what can we do? I mean, this is the biggest push. This is my biggest thing is it needs to be labeled because you have to do research otherwise.
It needs to be illegal, Rick, because, I mean, it should be illegal. It should be pushed to be illegal. Anything that causes I am, you know, to go back to the gay marriage thing, they use that as a smokescreen, and I've always said that you can't legislate morality, okay? You only legislate things that cause harm. These things cause harm. You know, we've thrown the hypothetical out there that, you know, even if one thing goes wrong, you know, let's just say that they do have the best intentions. Well, if they do, then we need to find out what's causing all this other stuff. What's causing the increase in ADD? What's causing the increase in autism? Because I can tell you right now, it's not just the vaccines. It's not.
Right, and where's the science
it is
behind
vaccines,
it? And why is it,
with it. It's
why is it pushed through
it.
The FDA? That why is it automatically FDA from someone who was appointed, you know, the head of the FDA?
You know, I don't know about little boys, but girls are starting their menses much earlier now, too. And
yeah.
This has been traced back to food. So I don't know if boys are starting to mature earlier also.
I think that is something that's common, Ruth Ann, is that kids are starting to develop and go through puberty earlier. And we're seeing an increase in mental health issues also, and it's not just psychiatry because they do have their own agenda. I believe that, but that's a whole other issue. But I think that, and going back to the aspartame, you know, anxiety and depression was that some of the studies related to people that have high, you know, that have diets high in aspartame, because it attacks the brain.
Yeah,
it attacks the brain, and it's just. It just destroys you from head to toe.
Evan. You know, Evan, you know, when you're talking about that being devil's advocate, because, again, I like to see all sides. You know, my girlfriend, she has her master's degree in this, what we're talking about, with, you know, psychology and so forth, and with the statistics of, you know, autism, ADD, ADHD, she deals with this all the time. Not just her, but Evan, you know, knowing that we were going to be talking about this, whether we were going to be talking about this tonight or not, I'm very passionate, obviously. It's something that people should understand that, okay, one argument could be, no, 40 years ago, there were just as many kids with ADHD or autism or something to that effect. And it's only because of new ways of diagnosing it that has made it seem like there's been a jump. And I have to say, talking clinically with experts, that is complete nonsense. There has been a huge jump, no matter how you want to describe it, in autism, in these things with children. And diet is definitely a part of it. And, you know, we can talk about vaccines. Actually, next week we're going to be getting into that a little bit with the RFID. But this whole GMO thing, it's only a matter of time before that's just going to keep increasing. I just want to make that clear.
The main problem, too, is how do they, and your girlfriend can attest to this, is, you know, how when you diagnose ADD, that's only speculation. There's not a blood test for that.
No,
there's not
a urinalysis
for that. There's not. And so, and what's the first thing that most doctors do? They don't recommend a change in diet. They don't ask if your kid has a diet high in aspartame. They give them a drug that contains a Schedule II narcotic in it, amphetamines. That's exactly what they're doing. They're giving kids speed, legal speed.
I wish I had her on right now. She would completely agree with you.
Because there's no test, Rick. There's no test whatsoever. And, you know, what really got me started...
The point is, though, Evan, 40 years ago, we didn't... Just be honest. Just look around. Just kids and adults alike are not having the same issues that they did back then. However you want to...
Yeah, how many people now go to the doctor and they say, I'm having mood swings, and all of a sudden they're on lithium for being bipolar?
Yeah.
Right.
You know? I mean,
that didn't happen 30 years ago.
ADD and manic depression... They are garbage bucket diagnoses, okay? And a lot of this stuff can be traced back to people's diets. And like what Ruth Ann said earlier, it's terrible. It's the integrity of the soil is gone because they've stripped it. The methods of agriculture now are we said mature content, they're piss poor.
So folks are listening, when Evan's talking about what Ruth had mentioned, like stripping the content, what you're basically saying is if you grew, you know, a field of corn or you had, you know, tomatoes, let's say you get 80% vitamin C or something from that, because the soil has been reused and stripped so much,
it goes down to
30%, then only 5% of what you got many years ago.
And it also changes, and this is important to note too, it also changes the bioavailability of these things. And that's why it's important to adopt a diet as similar as you can to Ruth Ann's, because the difference between taking all those vitamins, which they do have some benefit, but they have a very low bioavailability compared to good, healthy, organic food that's absorbed right away into the bloodstream.
And the vitamin
absorbed right away into your muscles, into your organs, into your brain. You know, we're talking about bioavailability too. It changes the whole structure of everything. Now, we talk about soil stripping. This is how Monsanto's using these things to justify their cause. This is how they're playing devil's advocate. They're saying our crops are resistant to harsher winters. Our crops can grow in harsher conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Where crops could no longer grow organically, our crops are growing, and we're able to provide food for everybody for a starving world. Well, we know damn well and good here in the United States, you know, we throw out enough garbage to feed the whole world.
Yeah.
We do. We throw out enough food that we could feed the whole world. We don't need Monsanto. We don't. We never did. We absolutely never did. I think, you know, when I was growing up, and I turned 31 on April the 28th, and I was growing up, you know, the statistic was less than 3% of the labor force was in agriculture. And we still produced more food than the entire country could eat. And Monsanto wasn't as big then. They really made their debut in 93 whenever they started injecting cows with hormones for their milk. You know, there's the milk again. You know, it all starts with the milk, which, you know, it's considered a staple for everybody. All the milk commercials, got milk. Well, now you got Monsanto. You got pesticides and growth hormones in your milk. In China, you got human DNA in cow's milk. There's rice now with human DNA in it. There's goats that BBC reported on that give spider silk protein in their milk. And these are not, this may sound crazy to everybody. I may sound like a raving lunatic. You know, I was accused of that in my RFID blog, even though I cited legislation. But I'm telling you guys, you can watch the clips. You know, don't take my word for it. I've got the clips and I've got the sources on my blog.
Yeah.
You can go to Google. Everybody listening can go to Google and put in spider goats. You're going to see goats that look just like normal goats. It's not like they have eight legs or anything, but they're given silk in their milk. I mean, this is how strange things are getting. And if they can do that, what do you think they're doing to our food? Human DNA in rice? Human DNA in rice. Why would you have that? Why? What's the purpose of human DNA in rice?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why I want to come the opposite. Then maybe there's a positive. It's just that this is why I'm glad we're having these discussions. Is let's pretend that there is completely logical reasons for putting human DNA into rice, or maybe it can. Alleviate ailments. It can cure cancer. It can do these sorts of things.
Maybe we can get more of our own natural nutrients back from consuming our own DNA. Maybe we can.
But you know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see it labeled.
But we should know.
And I'd like
some
research
on
it.
Yeah.
Before I go get a chicken noodle soup, I'd like to know if there's, you know, something in there such as that. I mean, it's that simple. To me, it's that basic. These things need to be labeled, and yes, boo, wake up, people. Your kids are involved.
Have you guys been seeing, you know, so many gluten-free things now? So many people talking about allergies to gluten?
Oh, gluten, technically everybody's allergic to gluten at some level because it's nothing but it's a mutated plant. It's
exactly.
A mutated byproduct. Yeah,
it's becoming more prevalent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's what they say. The wheat that we have now is nothing like what we had maybe 15, 20 years ago.
There's like 23,000 amino acids in it, right, Ruthann? Isn't it like 23,000 mutated proteins or something like that now in wheat?
Yeah. It's
incredible.
It's beyond... you know, so we're telling people, well, use other kinds of flours and things, and then there's always, you know, something wrong if it's coming from, like, quinoa or something, which I'm one of those people that loves. Well, you know, the people that are growing it don't make enough money to be able to eat it now. You know,
Right.
Well, Ruth, when you say that.
As an alternative to gluten, use rice flour. Now we just got done talking about how they're putting human DNA in rice. You know,
right.
So
that's what I mean, Ruthann. Yeah, sorry, you guys, but Ruthann, when you're saying using different types of flour, that's really what I want to get to for people that are listening, because, you know, right now people might be going, this isn't a big deal, but they really should. It's just a matter of time before it happens. What can they do? What kinds of flour can they look for? I mean, I always recommend farmers markets.
Oh, definitely. What you can. There are great companies, Baker's Creek, just Google them. They're in Missouri. Evan might know about them. They also are doing some work in California, I think. They are a family-run seed company, and they put in a lot of money and effort fighting Monsanto. So, you know, you go for as much as you can do, even if you have a balcony, grow something on it, grow tomatoes, grow something. There's all kinds of ways you can grow plants. But
buy heirloom seeds. That's what Baker Creek's all about. Yeah, buy the heirloom seeds. That's important. Hydroponics. Hydroponics, that's big, because I mean, if you're living in an urban area, guys, it's absolutely possible to grow your vegetables in nothing but water. It is possible. I mean, there's so many things that you can do inside your house and you can do in your backyard. And you know, I'm guilty of not doing it. I should do it. I know how to do it. I've cooked since I was 9, but I mean, we have to get off our asses.
No, St. Louis has some great community gardens. A lot of cities do. And their rooftop gardening, everything, like you said, I mean, you can grow something where you are. If you've got a yard, you know, like they have this saying about gardens, not lawns. you know, like food, not lawns.
Right.
We don't need all that. Just
front yard gardens now.
Right.
Front yard gardens.
Yeah.
What's a friend of ours on Facebook, Cindy Collins, Rick? She's big into that in front yard gardens.
Yeah.
I always see that on her post, and that's a great idea. Yeah, it's a great idea, that kind of stuff.
When you grow these things, you buy them from the farmers markets. You can also dry them to preserve them. People still can and freeze. You know, so you can stretch things out. Actually, I keep my place very cool, and I had tomatoes from the garden in January, and I had to put them in the fridge. Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah, because I can't stand those tomatoes, you know, what they call tomatoes that they sell in the stores.
You know, they do taste different from a culinary standpoint. There's not a chef in the world. Okay, there's not a chef in the world, and I have cooked for the world champion Cardinals, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a chef in the world that would say, you know, I would rather have a GMO piece of produce over organic. You know, if it's possible, if it can meet, you know, yields and it can meet cost, they're going to go with organic because it tastes better.
Oh, it tastes so much better.
Natural food tastes better.
Yeah.
It does. It absolutely does.
Well, I feel so sad because Rick was talking about kids and, you know, baby food and formula. And we've got kids now who've never tasted real food.
Right.
And
right.
And it's just so sad. Everything that's coming out of a package.
Lunchables.
And, you know, it's just sad.
So here's the thing, guys. Here's an idea, and this is something that I've always had this idea, you know, especially if we're in cities, and, you know, like us, we know each other. So let's hypothetically, Ruth Ann, Rick, and I, Rick, where are you from? Scottsdale.
I'm in Mesa, Arizona. Yeah.
Okay. Let's say we all live in Mesa. We're in, you know, a medium sized town, and we're in Mesa, Arizona, and we don't have a lot of space, so. Ruth Ann grows a couple of different things. Rick grows a couple of different things. I grow a couple of different things. We're all on the same page. We're all on the same mindset. So what do we have? We have a co-op now.
Exactly.
So we can trade. We can trade. We can barter. We can add variety in things to each other's lives and cooperate with each other.
Right.
And contribute certain things. So we say, okay, Ruth Ann, you're going to take care of the red stuff. So she's growing peppers and tomatoes, and then I'm taking care of cucumbers and root vegetables, and Rick is taking care of lettuce and spinach, and then, you know, we have other friends that do things.
I completely agree, Evan. We're running out of time, you guys. There's a site called meetup.com. It's not a dating site. If you want to look up co-ops, I recommend that. Thank you both, Ruth Ann and Evan.
That was great, yeah.
For being here tonight, and keep in mind that next week, Evan and I are going to be talking about RFID chips and implants. And for those of you thinking, oh, what does that mean? It's no big deal. Sort of a mini GPS system. Hello, folks. You are already tagged. It's in your Visa cards. It's in your passports. It's in your clothing.
Walmart's putting it in their jeans as tags. They're putting it in their Walmart's putting it in all their products that you buy, and you don't even know where they're at.
And they can even be injected through vaccinations.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, both of you, tonight. This was great. I think we need to follow up because there's still more to get to. But
it's obvious this makes all three of us angry. It does.
Yeah.
It really does. I am hot right now. I am just really pissed off.
I am too.
Yeah.
Three angry people.
Right. I'm just really mad. They're killing our people. They are. They're killing us. And I'm just really mad about it. But we got a lot of information out tonight. We did.
Yep.
We really got a lot of information out. And we got
so
a
everyone,
whole lot
please,
more to get
please
out.
Please, check out on Facebook, Scream the News, and check
Absolutely.
Out evanbatterton.wordpress.com. We will be providing more links for this, and Ruth Ann, of course, always thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us. And I just want to say, Scream the News, what a great variety group. So, I mean, every day, every 5 minutes, there's always something new, a brand new article that you wouldn't see anywhere. What a great group on Facebook.
It is.
Thank you.
Yeah,
great
so much.
Group.
Yeah, okay. See you next week.
Thanks, guys.
All right, guys.
Have a great evening.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.